From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. And Peter, the numbers just keep getting worse. A staggering 40,000 new COVID-19 cases reported yesterday across the United States. Big spikes in Texas and in Florida. That 40,000 number breaks the previous highest number reported back in April.
Right. And in response, some states are pausing or even rolling back their plans to reopen. You mentioned Texas. Well, today, the governor, Greg Abbott, is ordering bars and restaurants to shut down again. Dr. Peter Hotez is dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Doctor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And the governor of Texas going further now, doing more than just putting a pause on reopening. What's your reaction? Does it go far enough?
Yeah, it's important, although I think even additional measures may also be required. But the problem is this. We are now seeing this very aggressive vertical rise in the number of cases of COVID-19 in Houston, and it's being paralleled by a sharp uptick in hospitalizations and ICU admissions, and the numbers continue to grow along this exponential curve. We're now on the vertical part of that slope, and with no obvious end in sight if we maintain the status quo.
To that point, in Houston at the Texas Medical Center, we see reports that every ICU bed is in use. How dire is a situation like that?
We're actually doing much better than in the Texas Medical Center than some of the numbers actually show. We have extra capacity that has not been, you know, accurately reported on the website and in the press. You know, the Texas Medical Center is the world's largest. We have upwards of 3,000 ICU beds. So we still have room. That's not really the issue. The issue is the community transmission is going off the rails and the numbers are climbing with some of the predictive models, like those coming out of University of Pennsylvania, are saying that as terrible as these numbers are, we may be looking at 4,000 cases of COVID-19 just in Harris County, Houston, after July 4th weekend. And nobody would be able to manage that. And the numbers are not quite as dire in Austin and Dallas and San Antonio, but they're getting there as well. So we are, in many respects, the epicenter of COVID-19 in America as this way. And it's part of a bigger recrudescence or relapse across the American Southwest, Arizona, Nevada, Oklahoma, Arkansas. So it's quite dire, and we need to take aggressive action now.
On the issue of rolling back reopening as opposed to just putting a pause on reopening, you mentioned Arizona. That's another state that had put a pause on reopening plans. Just talk about that for a minute, because keeping the status quo is how we got to this problem with the infection rate in the first place, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. It's very, very straightforward. The status quo is not working for us. We did this attempt to open ahead of when the epidemiologic models told us we could get back to what they call containment mode, meaning less than one new case per million residents per day. We knew this. We knew COVID-19 would return, and we knew it would happen along an exponential curve. And the problem with exponential curves is they look kind of flat for a while, so it builds in extra complacency, and then people say, "Hey, we're done," and they start piling back into bars and socializing, and now we're seeing that very steep rise. So just keeping the status quo is not going to help, and we can't continue to wait because those numbers will accelerate. And as I said, the models are practically apocalyptic in terms of where this will head.
Now, you mentioned people are cramming into bars, and in fact, in this spike, we have seen more and more young people getting infected. Is that a failure in messaging? I mean, I'm just wondering how public health officials can convince people in their 20s and 30s to be more careful. I mean, maybe closing the bars is one option, but you've got to convince them that this is a problem.
That's the narrative that's out there, but I haven't really seen all the supporting data. I'm sure, you know, anecdotally, there are a lot of young people going into bars and getting sick, but I can't say with confidence that that's the predominant numbers of individuals getting infected just yet. And one of the areas that I'm really worried about are the low-income neighborhoods here in Houston, which where we don't they don't have adequate access to public health messaging and healthcare, and many of these people cannot work remotely. They can't work by Skype and Zoom. They physically have to be in the workplace in order to support their families, and we really need to look after them. So I've been trying to raise awareness of the fact that, you know, in this part of the country, COVID-19 is first and foremost a health disparity. I've had to go out of my comfort zone because I'm very upset personally when I see what's happening, but also trying to wake people up into what's needed, and it's starting to work. So I've made this call that we need to start dialing things back now before the weekend, and hopefully people are hearing it.
Dr. Peter Hotez is Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Doctor, thank you. I know it's a very busy time.
Thanks so much.
Well, the rise in cases of COVID-19 has reignited both dissent and shaming over face masks on social media. Let's bring in Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, for our weekly social media roundup. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
And what are you seeing online about the face mask debate?
Some extraordinary scenes. For instance, a senior trying to get into a supermarket, tackled by security. The senior falls on the floor. Then he proceeds to run around the aisles because he doesn't want to wear a face mask. A number of online publications are saying that if you hear from the FTBA, the Freedom to Breathe Association, they do not exist. It is made up. If somebody comes along and gives you that card at a store saying, I don't need to wear a mask, that is a made up organization. But a Facebook group that are trying to insist on what they are saying, their rights not to wear a mask. And I'm going to call this the Hobson fake test, Jeremy, because you always say, if you look at something and you're not sure if it's true, check for spelling errors. And yes, there is a spelling error on this certificate, this little card that says, I don't need to wear a mask to go into your store. So that is the Hobson fake test. Let me leave one last thought with you on this topic about to wear or not to wear masks. This is Dr. Emily Porter on Twitter. She says, wear a mask. That is, unless you want to be intubated by a gynecology intern, July the 1st, who did her last semester of med school via Zoom. That is a warning.
And by the way, for listeners who were not tuned in last week to our segment, the Hobson fake test is that I was saying that every time there's a troll on Twitter or something is fake news, they usually
spell
things wrong.
Spell.
They just can't spell. Let's talk about Parler, or is it Parlay? This is a new social media network that Republican Senator Ted Cruz is joining to fight against so-called big tech. Listen.
With another presidential election just months away, I'm working in the Senate every day to hold big tech accountable to the American people and to make sure that your voices are heard. That's why I'm proud to join Parler. This platform gets what free speech is all about, and I'm excited to be a part of it.
Okay, so Femi, what is Parler and who's using it?
Social media platform. Looks similar to Twitter, similar to other social media platforms that you may use on as an app. You can message, you can follow people. When you join it, you're offered a number of, I would say, conservative influencers, really well-known conservative influencers, well-known conservative publications. You can follow their feeds, you can comment, you can share. Some people who've been thrown off Twitter, you will now find them on Parler. And what it is giving you is an experience if you, I would say, have a political point of view that is probably more conservative than most people on Twitter, for instance, you will find a lot of like-minded people on the same platform. Now, Parler isn't saying that we are a political platform. They're not even saying we're a conservative platform. They're saying that we are a community. We're not going to regulate you. You can talk and you've got a freedom of speech, etc. But if you look at it very carefully, you will see a lot of people who have conservative views all on that one platform.
All right, one more thing I want to get to. The British rock legend Rod Stewart has been trending this week for an unusual reason, and his fans have been coming out in full force to defend his honor.
So many fans of Rod Stewart. Who knew? So Maggie Haberman wrote an article, and she used an analogy. She compared President Trump to the Rod Stewart of politicians. He may keep coming up with new material, but deep down, he knows his fans want to hear Wake Up Maggie. So he keeps playing the same tune because he can't stand the thought of them not loving his performance. That was the analogy. Well, The fans were not happy with that. And let me just give you one response back, which sums up the thousands of responses and pushback to Maggie Haberman's article and analogy. This one comes from Triple X, JD Triple X. The song's title is Maggie May. Rod Stewart is one of the best-selling artists of all time, was knighted and inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He had 16 other top 10 singles. He also fabulously covered Motown and Great American Songbook. You are insufferable. That summed up the pushback.
What's your favorite Rod Stewart song?
If you think I'm sexy.
That is Femi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English.
Can I take that Femi back?
Nope, sorry, too late. Thank you, Femi.
Bye.
An hour before a midnight deadline yesterday, the Trump administration filed a brief asking the Supreme Court to overturn all of President Obama's Affordable Care Act. The court will likely hear arguments on the case this fall, in the middle of a pandemic and an election season. Joining us to look at that and other news from the week on Capitol Hill is NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
And let's start with the Affordable Care Act. Republicans have wanted to get rid of this law for years. What's the Trump administration arguing now?
Well, they're basically arguing that Congress rendered the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional when they zeroed out the penalty for failing to buy insurance. People may remember that as the individual mandate, and it was supposed to phase in, but congressional Republicans stepped in and removed the penalty. You know, we often hear them talking about how they killed the individual mandate, but by law, it actually still exists. It's just the penalty is $0, and they could theoretically restore it in a future Congress. But what the administration is arguing is that Congress intended all elements of the Affordable Care Act to work together in tandem. And if one pillar is gone, that being the individual mandate, then the whole thing has to go.
Now, let's be clear. The administration and Republicans have tried to get rid of this, but they haven't yet come up with anything to replace it. And that's going to be tough in this climate.
Oh, absolutely. And that's part of why they abandoned later attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act before the 2018 election, because they couldn't agree on how to replace it. It's actually a drama that kept on playing out and turned into a major message of that 2018 midterm election. Democrats say it's part of why they won so dramatically and took control of the House. I mean, it was the election of health care. Democrats said that they were there to protect your health care and Republicans were there to take it away. And voters heard that. And it came at a time when public sentiment and support for the ACA had climbed to really record highs, particularly the portion that protects people with pre-existing conditions, which is still popular now.
And this time around, it comes at a time of a massive global pandemic. More than 124,000 people have died in this country. What do you make of the timing and the optics trying to make a big switch with healthcare in the middle of this health crisis?
Democrats are already all over this. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called it an act of unfathomable cruelty last night in a statement. You know, they say that in this moment, there are millions of people losing jobs. And for a lot of people, that means losing their employer-sponsored health care. Democrats say those people are looking for coverage on the exchanges that were created by the ACA. And if you got rid of it, there would be millions and millions of additional uninsured people. And that is something that they say is completely unacceptable in this time.
And what about the timeline here? It will be argued in the fall, very likely decided after the election. I assume it's safe to say this is going to play a big role in the general election.
You can definitely bet that. We don't know exactly when the arguments will happen, but the filing itself guarantees that this will be part of what people are messaging on. You know, Democrats are already saying that science is on the ballot. That's the way that Pelosi has been framing it. And, you know, healthcare, as I said before, was really successful for Democrats in 2018, and now they get to revive that in a presidential year.
I want to ask you about coronavirus relief efforts. I'm sure you've seen the numbers here. The U.S. reported 40,000 new cases of COVID-19 yesterday. That was a record for the second day in a row. Are these numbers at all changing the conversation on Capitol Hill about whether or not another relief package is on its way?
We do know that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that he wants to make this an issue for the month of July, and he says that any new relief will begin in the Senate. Now, that isn't really a good clue as to what will be in the package, though, because Republicans and Democrats really disagree about what should be included. Democrats say that there needs to be expanded unemployment insurance. That's $600 that unemployed people get now from the federal government. It expires at the end of July, and Democrats worry that people won't be able to make rent or will have to be choosing between, say, keeping the lights on and paying for medicine without that additional money. But Republicans are really resistant to moving forward with that. So I expect that's going to be a big part of the fight.
Kelsey, weigh in on one of the primary races that is making headlines this week. Congressman Elliot Engel, a Democrat of New York, for more than 30 years, chair of the powerful House Foreign Affairs Committee, appears to have lost his primary. Now, the results are not confirmed yet, but Jamal Bowman, a black middle school principal and a progressive, is ahead. How's this going over among Democrats?
You know, it's House Speaker Pelosi was asked about this, and she said that she wasn't clear that it was decided yet if Engel had lost his race. So I think that speaks a little bit to where Democrats are on this.
Establishment backing him up.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know if this is a trend or how this will play out going forward, but there is obviously a lot of energy in the progressive side of the Democratic Party and in that movement. Should note that this is a race very similar in many, many ways to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez when she challenged Joe Crowley in New York there. So the dynamics as I've talked to strategists, they say they're quite similar. So we'll wait and see if this plays out at a greater scale in the upcoming election.
All right. That's NPR's congressional correspondent, Kelsey Snell. Thanks for joining us, as always.
Thank you.
A mandate requiring people to wear masks in public went into effect today in Nevada. Here's Governor Steve Sisolak, a Democrat, announcing the order earlier this week.
We owe it to each other to accept the fact that wearing face mask coverings saves lives. We owe it to the many workers, the healthcare professionals, retail clerks, restaurant workers, grocery store employees, to accept that fact as the truth.
Diana Thomas is a housekeeper at the Flamingo Las Vegas Resort and Casino and a member of the Culinary Union, which has been calling for a statewide mask order as coronavirus cases spike in Nevada. Diana, welcome. How do you feel about the governor's order?
Oh, very happy. Very, very happy. I'm so ecstatic about it because working at the hotel that I work at right now, we have to wear masks, and I was worried about the customers, and now that it's mandatory, I'm super happy.
Resorts and casinos on the Strip started to reopen on June 4th. They'd been closed for many weeks before then. What has it been like? I mean, are the casinos crowded? Are people showing up in Las Vegas?
Yeah, they're showing up in Las Vegas, but the thing, I just wanted them to be safe while we're opening up. It's been in between. I can't say too crowded, but just, you can say medium.
Yeah. So people are walking around, going to bars and restaurants, that sort of thing.
Yes. They're walking around without any masks.
Okay. So they're walking around without masks. Many of these people, by the way, are coming from all over the place. So, you know, you don't know where they're coming from, if they're coming from a hot spot or not. But when you're inside somebody's room and you're cleaning it, what's going through your mind? Do you feel safe?
No, I don't feel safe, and especially me cleaning inside the room. Like, I have an asthmatic son, right? I almost lost him 3 times. So I want it to be real safe in the rooms as I'm cleaning. You know, I don't know who's been in there, you know, so I don't want to bring anything home to my son. I'd rather for it to be safe than sorry.
Yeah, sure. What precautions are you taking when you're cleaning these rooms?
Well, it's extensive cleaning. I wear my mask. I wear my gloves. Every time I go and enter into each room, I change my gloves.
Now, there are calls to require mandatory room cleaning every day at the hotels. How would that help?
It will help tremendously. Cleaning the rooms every day will keep the germs away. I made a rhyme, huh? Yeah, it will. Seriously.
The CDC is going to take that from you.
Okay, right? And remember, I said it first. But
well, tell me more about that. Why is it important?
It's important. Like I mentioned earlier in the conversation, I do have an asthmatic son. I would like for to clean the rooms mandatory every day. It'll be better for me and everybody else and my family.
At one point, nearly 60,000 casino workers in your union were laid off or furloughed because of the pandemic. And I assume you were one of them.
Yes.
How's that gone for you? How's it been?
how's it going for me being laid off? It was scary. It was a little bit frustrating. So I may do what I have to do, is work out, keep my hands washed, and just stay precaution at all time.
You're in a tough spot, though, because I guess on the one hand, you know, I'm sure you want to be working to pay your bills. On the other hand, you need to stay healthy. You need your son to stay healthy. Would you be in favor of shutting down again if the governor's mask order doesn't work and it doesn't slow down infections?
The only thing we can do is be safe, follow the procedures. Is some people who want to do what they want to do, but me, as a mother, a single mother, I'm going to take precautions. But not only do I have a sickly son, I have a grandson to take care of too. So I don't want to bring that down. So if we do close again, it'll be on the people who were irresponsible. It will not be on the people who was following the rules. Do what you're supposed to do. I wouldn't want it to close down because I can't afford it, because I am a single parent and I would want to work, but I want to work safely. I don't want to go to work unsafe.
I see that some of your coworkers at the Flamingo have gotten sick with COVID-19. Does that worry you?
Of course it does. I don't know the coworkers, but I know 17 of my members of the culinary union have died. So it would be better safe than sorry to test each employee. We don't have to know their names. We just need to keep them safe.
Diana Thomas is a member of the culinary union and a housekeeper at the Flamingo Las Vegas Hotel and Casino. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
She was once undocumented. Now she writes about the undocumented immigrants we often ignore.
Day laborers, housekeepers, delivery men, people who don't inspire hashtags or t-shirts.
That's coming up on Code Switch.
Warning, this next item is about toilets. Space toilets, to be exact. NASA needs a new one, and the top three design teams that can come up with a new space toilet for an expedition to the moon in a few years will share a prize of $35,000. It's called the Lunar Loo Challenge, and Mike Interbartolo is the project manager. He joins me now. Mike, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and people may be eating right now, so we want to be a little delicate about this, but why does NASA need a new space toilet design? What have they been using up until now?
So we have a toilet. It's pretty capable on the space station right now, and we're about to test a new one called the UWMS up there, but it's a little bit too heavy for what we've been constrained to for the lunar lander. Because our toilet has to go down to the moon's surface and back up again, any mass that we bring down cost propellant to bring it down as well as bring it back up again.
And you can't just use like a bag, like a plastic bag or a space diaper for that matter.
A space diaper, we use that during spacewalks, and a bag, we did that back in the Apollo era, and the astronauts did not like it at all. It just was uncomfortable for them. There was a release at least once, I believe it was Apollo 10, where the commander noted there was a floating object in the cabin. And so we knew going back to the moon this time, because they're going to be living on the surface of the moon for 6.5 days, and it's a longer transit time down to the surface and back up to orbit, that it just didn't make sense to put the astronauts through such a bad experience again for so long.
And forgive me, but there would be no way while they're on the surface of the moon for there to just be some sort of hatch and just go on the moon.
You could talk about that in terms of a more camper style toilet. But the issue is, again, you need a toilet system for the transit down and back. So you might as well make a fully capable low mass system that works for both scenarios.
Mm-hmm. So are you getting a lot of interest in this Lunar Loo Challenge so far?
We've definitely gotten a lot of articles written at this point. And there's been on the challenge page on Hero X, I've already started getting notifications of ideas flowing in. So I haven't had a chance to look at any of the entries yet, but the tinkerers, the makers, and the citizen scientists out there have about 8 weeks to put their brain trust together and try to come up with innovative ideas for this challenge. And we also have a junior category, which allows the kids under 18 to come up with fun and creative ways that they think a toilet should look like for going back to the moon in 2024.
Has NASA ever thrown any ideas like this to the public in the past and asked for people to come up with solutions to big problems?
Yeah, we've used this platform for crowdsourcing ideas in the past, and it's yielded great results because the folks bring in different perspectives and their own experience base drives some innovation and ideas that we wouldn't have access to otherwise.
Now, of course, it's easy to make jokes about the Lunar Lude challenge, but it is important, of course, as you've been talking about. But what is the worst joke you've heard about the project?
So there's been a lot of dad jokes on email that have gone around. We're going to be flush with ideas and whatnot. Yeah, that, you know, they sort of write themselves at this point. But so far, everyone seems really excited about the challenge, and we're definitely looking forward to seeing the creativity that the crowd can bring to such a problem that is important to the astronauts as we try to get back to the moon by 2024.
That is Mike Interbartolo of NASA. He is the project manager for the Lunar Lude Challenge, and we will link you to that at hereandnow.org, and you can enter a design. Maybe you will be the one who comes up with the winning design. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he won't take up the police reform bill that passed yesterday in the House, which has left police reform at an impasse in Congress. Georgia Representative Hank Johnson joins us now. He's a Democrat and member of the Congressional Black Caucus. Congressman, welcome.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
Well, and you were involved in the drafting of this massive House police reform bill. It did pass, but the Senate Majority Leader says it won't go anywhere in the Senate. Do you think there's any chance at this point of your bill becoming law?
Yeah, I think that the public pressure on the Senate may well result in the Senate sitting down with the House to negotiate something that Republicans in the Senate can vote for. But more than likely, it's the true that the Republicans are simply not interested in doing police reform legislation. And we'll have to wait until next year with a new Senate. Hopefully, the Grim Reaper will not be leading the Senate, and we can get some legislation accomplished in that domain over there.
So you would rather wait until next year, hope that the election goes the way that you want it to, and get something more monumental passed next year than try to at least get something that you can agree on with Republicans in the next month or so?
No, I think that we stand ready to, in good faith, negotiate with the Republicans for a meaningful legislative response to what everyone can see is a clear and present problem, and that is the unjustified killing of Black people in America by police officers. It's something that everybody knows is taking place with great and disturbing regularity. And everybody knows that it's time for Congress to take some concrete action so that we can start holding offending police officers accountable for what they do. When they're accountable, then they will reform their actions. And so right now it's a period of impunity, and it's time for that to stop. And that's what the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act does.
Well, when you look at some of the Republican criticism of what Democrats like you have been trying to do, your colleague in the House, Debbie Lesko, says the federal mandates in this bill go too far. President Trump has said that Democrats just want to weaken the police and take away immunity. How do you respond to those criticisms?
Well, we heard the same coded language when it was involving civil rights legislation. It was always a matter of states' rights and local control. But yet those states and those localities receive federal dollars. And when they receive federal money, they are subject to federal values. And so the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act lays down some basic principles that require police law enforcement agencies to adhere to certain federal values. And those values respect life, respect liberty, respect due process. And if the states will not do it, the House of Representatives under Democratic control have stepped up with some meaningful legislation to address the problem.
Did you work with any Republicans on the drafting of this bill, given the fact that we are in a divided government situation and eventually some Republicans are going to have to come on board with anything that passes?
Well, I mean, the legislative process works with each party drafting whatever legislation they want to draft. And then you can work with members of the other party to work out amendments. And unfortunately, the Republicans did not show any willingness to work with House Democrats on amendments. And unable to work with them, we had to go forward with what we had, and we passed it yesterday. And I think three Republicans voted for that legislation.
Right.
So it was bipartisan.
Well, so would you counsel Senate Democrats then to allow Republicans to pass Tim Scott's bill in the Senate, and then you can work out the differences in conference?
The Senate Democrats are interested in legislation that addresses the problem. They're not looking at window dressing. And I believe that that's the spirit within which the senators are posturing, so as to force the Grim Reaper to allow his Republican colleagues to work with the House Democrats and work with Senate Democrats. In fact, Cory Booker and Kamala Harris were essential to the drafting of the House legislation.
And for our listeners who are just tuning in, by the way, the Grim Reaper, when you refer to the Grim Reaper, you're talking about the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, and that's what he refers to himself as.
Uh-huh. Let me just ask you about COVID-19, because Georgia hit a record high of new confirmed cases this week. Your state's lieutenant governor told NPR yesterday that he stands by the decision to begin reopening that state back in April. Do you think Georgia needs to follow what Texas did today and start shutting back down again?
Yeah, unfortunately, we have leadership in Georgia that follows what others are doing, as opposed to leading the way to protect and safeguard Georgians. So I think whenever President Trump gives an okay, then Georgia officials will do the right thing and start cutting back on these reopenings. And unfortunately, it's our African-American, it's our black people in Georgia who are bearing the brunt of this decision-making by politicians in Georgia who are following President Trump, who's got his head in the sand on this whole issue.
That is Hank Johnson, a Democratic congressman from the state of Georgia. Congressman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Iran has been hit hard by the coronavirus, but the process of reopening is well underway. Religious shrines, mosques, even restaurants and cafes are once again welcoming visitors as long as they observe social distancing and other rules. NPR's Peter Kenyon has been calling Iranians to ask them what they expect going forward.
Mitra and Amir are a married couple in their early 30s living in northern Iran. Like all the people who agreed to be interviewed for this story, they asked that their last names and precise location not be used, for fear of retribution for speaking by WhatsApp to Western media. Mitra says in their area, the reopening appears to be all but complete.
All the shops, restaurants, and offices are opened. More or less, 90% of normal business life is back.
As to whether they agree with the timing of the government's decision to reopen, Mitra says as far as she's concerned, the government in Tehran is barely relevant, including during emergencies. While Tehran has issued guidelines generally in line with those of the World Health Organization, she says many private sector companies closed well before the government ordered it and will reopen when they think it's safe. Amir agrees with that assessment. The government makes a lot of decisions, he says, most of them for show. The government, he adds, has fallen behind its own people in the intelligence and speed of its actions. For his part, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said recently, in comments posted to the internet, that while he values health professionals, it's important to also consult religious experts on the question of reopening mosques and holy shrines. I do not have a suggestion on the topic. I respect the council's expert view, he said, before adding, but I do have advice. This topic should be given to those who deeply understand the importance of prayers and spirituality. Other Iranians agreed to provide comments if their voice isn't used. Nusheen, a woman in South Iran, says on the positive side, testing frequency and accuracy seem to be improving. On the other hand, she says, protective equipment is in short supply, with many people not even able to get proper masks. She adds that even though sanctions don't apply to medical supplies, it's hard for Iranian companies to access them, and those that do tend to have ties to the government. But as far as 33-year-old Amir is concerned, this is just the latest example of a government attempting to lead a population that has long since lost faith in its abilities. He says the official line, blaming the poor response to the coronavirus pandemic on American sanctions, has long since worn thin.
Obviously, a government under sanctions will have trouble with a pandemic, he says. But having said that, I think if 100% of the sanctions were lifted at the start, Iran's performance might have been about 2% better. In Tehran, a schoolteacher named Amir Hussein says he's sympathetic with the government's desire to salvage some kind of economic activity. But as a result, he fully expects a cycle of reopenings, resurgence of the virus, and more closings to kick in over the coming months. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
The culture of NASCAR is shifting thanks to the only full-time black driver in the Cup Series, Bubba Wallace. NASCAR recently banned the Confederate flag from events after Wallace pushed for it. And this week, Wallace was back in the news after his team discovered a noose in a garage that he'd been assigned to in Alabama. The FBI says it was a door pull made to look like a noose, and that it had been there for months before Wallace used the garage. Joining us now is Maya Jones, who's an associate editor at The Undefeated, who covers NASCAR. Maya, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and you've been covering Bubba Wallace for years. He's just 26 years old, and here he is now thrust into this position of standing up for black athletes. Let's listen to this. Here he is on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah on Wednesday.
I am not a political person at all. I try to avoid that at all costs. I walk straight and narrow down the path that I want to walk on. And, you know, it's crazy when everybody is all supportive when the president is at the Daytona 500 and it's all fine. That's all political to me.
So how is Bubba Wallace handling this spotlight?
I think he's handling it better than some people who have, you know, years of experience in this area. Bubba was the type of person who wanted to get out there and race. He didn't want to make it about his color. He didn't want to, you know, be thrust into the spotlight in this way, but he has sort of become this activist. And I'm not sure that when he tweeted 3 years ago that the sport would have a black driver that they would be hearing about for years and telling people to accept it and enjoy the ride, basically, I don't think he thought that all of this would come with it.
And what is it that he's up against? And what's the culture of NASCAR been like up until now? Because people might hear the FBI this week saying that no, a hate crime was not committed with that noose that was hanging in his garage. And then think, look, everything in this sport is fine. What's the big deal?
Although it wasn't a hate crime, they still used the term noose four times in their reporting. And a picture came out showing that it was indeed a noose, and it was the only garage door pull that was fashioned in this way. So we're seeing comments that, you know, calling Bubba basically a liar, saying that this was all a hoax. This was a ploy to get NASCAR's quote unquote token black driver are things that I've been seeing. They want to get him attention. So I think that's what NASCAR and Bubba Wallace are up against. Just because this wasn't a hate crime doesn't mean that they don't have hate and racism in NASCAR or in this country. So in the, you know, in the fan base, and you can't paint a whole fan base as racist. But once you see some of these comments and things being said, it's hard to ignore.
Well, that is true, but there is some evidence that some of the tension is still there. Just last week in Alabama, there were fans who were flying the Confederate flag outside the track, even though NASCAR had banned it. Someone had even hired an airplane to fly the flag overhead. So what is your sense of what's going to become of those fans who are resistant to these changes?
I think a lot of these fans, it's kind of a them problem. If you can't accept this change and the changes that NASCAR wants to implement going forward, then I think if they want to stay at home while new fans who are embracing and accepting a newer culture, they are willing to fill those seats.
Do you think so? I mean, do you think that this debate could actually make NASCAR stronger by bringing in new fans?
I think so, because I've been seeing a lot of positivity. I know there's a lot of negativity out there, but I've been seeing anywhere from casual fans who have never watched NASCAR to athletes, especially black athletes, asking questions and enjoying the race. A lot of people didn't give NASCAR a chance because they didn't feel welcome. It's not that they don't like cars. It's not that they don't like watching these drivers go 200 miles per hour. is really exciting, especially, you know, for people who have never seen it live. So I think that this is bringing in a lot of new people who are willing to give NASCAR a try now that it's becoming a more welcoming and inclusive environment. But I still think that there is a lot of work to be done. Just because it's a, you know, they have positive moments doesn't mean that they're not fighting an uphill battle.
I do think it's worth noting what NASCAR has done here as well. They rushed in to support Wallace. Unlike other sports, for instance, like the NFL, where many of its star players are black, and owners were nowhere near as quick to support them when they spoke out against racism. So how would you compare what NASCAR is doing to what's happening in other sports?
I think NASCAR is proving that they're serious about making diversity and inclusion a priority. And it's really sad that it's not happening that way in other sports. And a lot of athletes don't feel appreciated in the sports that they're in. But NASCAR, that show of support, just with all of the drivers surrounding Bubba, pushing his car, you know, standing with him. If nothing else came out of this moment, that was a beautiful moment that can't be taken away. Mm-hmm. So I think NASCAR has been responding accordingly. And I think they're listening to their black employees, their employees of color, and saying, yes, you do matter. And, you know, it's better late than never.
And maybe someday there will be more than one full-time black driver on the circuit. Maya Jones, an associate editor at The Undefeated, who writes about NASCAR. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.